our headlines. An information war in full swing over Ukraine. Moscow is opening a criminal case against U.S. tech giant Meta platforms for allowing death calls against Russian soldiers. UNICEF says the Saudi war could disrupt education for up to 6 million Yemeni children. Also ahead, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's so-called citizenship law is proof of the regime's racist nature. Thank you for joining us. The online video sharing platform YouTube says it is blocking access globally to media funded by the Russian government. The American platform says the decision is in line with its policy of barring content that denies, minimizes, or trivializes violent events. Earlier this month, YouTube also blocked leading Russian channels, RT and Sputnik, across Europe amid Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the American company Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says it is allowing posts that call for violence against Russian forces. In response, Moscow says it is restricting access to Instagram and has launched criminal proceedings against its parent company. The United Nations has also warned that the anti-Moscow move could spark hate speech against Russians. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett explains how Western media are engaged in a propaganda campaign backed by their governments to deceive the public about what's going on in the world.
Well, everything that you're watching on Russia Today and Sputnik and Press TV as well, these are the sources of truth. These are the source of accuracy. This is the real revelation of what is going on in the ground. You can't believe anything that is coming out of the Western media. So Americans are starved for truth. That's why they have been deceived for 20 years into these endless wars, because of the propaganda that has been forced upon them from their own CIA that manipulates these big tech companies. So we're seeing big tech and the political implosion in America and this emerging deep state just suddenly start coming apart. America has now been caught with evidence of crimes against humanity, bioweapons, violation of international treaties. They've actually went to the United Nations Security Council and are demanding investigations. And that yet again is another issue. The Americans are falling all over themselves, and they're doing it with absolutely no grace. The Biden administration officials are desperate to lie. This is done by people who have lost, who are in the corner, that are wounded and are about to be destroyed by the fire of their own lies.
Thank you.
Russia just needs to be very composed and say to the world, who do you believe, us and the facts and the evidence, or the liars who gave you 9/11 and 20 years of war against the entire world? And I think the world is going to come to the side of Iran and Russia. They just need time to see the truth.
Russia's military offensive in Ukraine is now on its 17th day as Russian forces bear down on the capital Kyiv, while the city of Lutsk, close to the Polish border, is targeted for the first time. Russian forces have repositioned and are regrouping northwest of Kyiv. Airfields in the western cities of Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk, have also come under attack. In east-central Ukraine, Russian strikes hit Dnipro for the first time, killing at least one person. Ukraine has accused Russian forces of hitting a psychiatric hospital near the eastern Ukrainian town of Izium. Russia's defense ministry says it would open humanitarian corridors from Kyiv, Sumy, Kharkiv, Mariupol, and Chernihiv. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated in recent days through humanitarian corridors. The UN Human Rights Office says nearly 600 civilians, including 41 children, have been killed in Ukraine so far. Staying with Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country has already reached a strategic turning point in the conflict with Russia and is moving towards victory. Zelensky says he does not know how many days it will take to coat free Ukrainian land, but they will do it. The president has rallied Ukrainians with a series of addresses from Kyiv since the conflict began on February the 24th. He has received support from other European states and the U.S., which have provided Ukraine with money and arms. They have also imposed tough sanctions on Russia, but turned down Zelensky's main demand. That is, a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Western countries say they do not want to directly engage in war with Russia. The EU has also dismissed Kyiv's fast accession to the bloc. Our correspondent Robert Carter is currently in the Polish city of Lublin to update us on the situation of Ukrainian refugees that have been fleeing to Poland. He says ordinary people in Poland are helping the refugees amid the absence of any organized campaigns by the United Nations and the European Union.
Obviously, the situation here is very dire for many refugees, many of whom don't have family here, don't have friends, they have nowhere specific to stay. And the conditions here, I have to say, are cold, icy, there's snow on the ground, temperatures can drop to -7 during the night here. So for women carrying maybe more than one child at the same time, and we've seen children here ages of one or younger that are trying to find shelter in Poland. So it's a very upsetting, very difficult situation to witness. And also, of course, the big question is who is being treated differently in terms of how has Europe responded to refugees coming from Ukraine compared to how refugees that have come from other parts of the world as well. And this is something which we've tried to get to the bottom of here in Poland, and hopefully we'll be reporting on that a little bit later. But question marks surrounding how Poland has handled the Ukrainian refugee crisis compared to how they've handled the Syrian or the African refugee crisis in the past has also raised a lot of questions here. We haven't seen anyone from the United Nations active here. All of the volunteer work that you see going on behind us is actually from Polish civilians who have literally taken time out of their busy schedule to help. In fact, when we went to the main train station here in Lublin, there was a room set up specifically to take in Ukrainian refugees and to help them board other trains, to give them food, to give them warmth. That was organized entirely by volunteers from Poland, Polish civilians. It was not organized by Polish authorities. It was not organized by the UN. It wasn't organized by the European Union. This was something done locally by honest, hardworking Polish civilians who just decided that they were going to help their Ukrainian brothers and sisters, people who they feel have a cultural link to them as neighbors.
A two-day European Union summit has ended in France without major sanctions on Russia. But the member states said historic changes in regards with their ties with Moscow may be arriving soon. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
A summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11 and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union. If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A majority of Americans disapprove of President Joe Biden's performance, especially over his handling of the rising inflation in the country. That's what a recent poll shows. It was conducted by the Wall Street Journal. The poll found that 57% of respondents disapproved of Biden's performance. On economy alone, 63% gave him negative marks. Half of respondents said inflation is a main concern for them. Only 42% approved of the president's job. That's roughly the same percentage in a November survey. Rising costs have been a persistent issue for Biden in recent months, despite efforts to unclog supply chains. And now the ongoing conflict in Ukraine has exacerbated U.S. inflation. That's due to rising energy and commodity prices in the wake of sanctions on Russia. Moving on, the United Nations Children's Fund says the war on Yemen has killed or maimed 47 minors in the first 2 months of 2022. UNICEF says over 10,000 minors were also killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. According to the UN Fund, as many as 6 million Yemeni children could see their education disrupted as a result of the war. It has warned against the tremendous long-term consequences of insufficient learning for these children. Saudi Arabia and its allies have destroyed Yemen's infrastructure, including schools and hospitals. The aggression has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and pushed millions into poverty and famine. Earlier, Melbourne-based journalist Samuel Geddes joined us with his take on UN inaction on Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe caused by the years-long Saudi war there.
We've been constantly told how Yemen is on the edge of a famine or on the edge of a particular kind of humanitarian crisis. But of course, it has been at that stage of crisis for 7 years. From the figures that I'm aware of, the death toll is close to 400,000, and of course the vast majority of those will be civilians, and particularly civilians with particular nutritional needs, so young children, people with underlying conditions, and the elderly. And yes, I mean, nearly a decade of such acute food crisis, as well as you say, disruption to the educational system and every other system. Yes, this will, without being an expert on child health, I would definitely say that this is going to leave very long-term scars on Yemeni society and on its future social and economic development.
Yemeni armed forces say they have carried out a large-scale drone operation targeting Saudi Arabia's oil facilities.
Our armed forces carried out a wide military operation, the first break siege operation, using 9 drones. The targeting of the Aramco refinery in the Saudi enemy's capital Riyadh using Samad 3 drones, the targeting of Aramco facilities in Jizan and Abha and other sensitive locations using 6 Samad 1 drones.
The army spokesman says the operation was a response to Riyadh's fuel embargo on Yemen. Saudi says his country is ready to carry out more operations in retaliation to Saudi Arabia's aggression and its blockade. The Saudi state news agency has cited a government official who confirmed that a refinery in Riyadh was attacked on Thursday. The news agency, however, said the attack caused a small fire that was contained and the refinery's operations and supplies were not affected. Earlier, we were joined by activist and political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti to get his thoughts on the operation in Saudi Arabia. Let's take a listen.
And as you know, that Saudi has enforced a siege on Yemen for the last almost 8 years. They are blocking especially fuel from entering the country. Many hospitals will be closed in the coming days. And just since Biden was sworn in as U.S. president, Saudi has only allowed handful of fuel ship, and this is actually the first time that fuel prices has increased by 400 to 500%. That's why I think that to call this operation, as they say, to break the siege, I believe that we have started now the countdown for a major attack only that will target Saudi oil infrastructure. And I think especially at this point, when we see the war between Russia and Ukraine, I think, and as well the fuel prices increasing in Europe and other Western countries, I think Yemeni should take this chance by attacking Saudi oil infrastructure. And we have seen that this latest attack that targeted with three drones Riyadh main refinery and as well other Saudi Aramco infrastructure and facilities in Abha and in Jizan region, I think that Yemenis are well equipped, and the Saudi and United States know that they maybe the other attack and the coming attack will maybe target Saudi major oil field, especially like in Khamis the major oil field in Baqiq and Khurais that was targeted a few years ago. And as well, United Arab Emirates should not think that they are far away from this attack, because the main goal behind this attack is to break the siege.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed Israel's so-called citizenship law, which bars Palestinian residents from living with their spouses from Gaza or occupied West Bank. Hamas spokesman Jihad Taha said the legislation reveals the true face of the occupying regime, which is after separating Palestinian families. Taha said the move aims at clearing Palestinian lands, especially Al-Quds, from their original residents. He noted that Hamas strongly rejects what he called the racist law. Spokesman added it is in violation of international norms, including the 1948 Global Declaration of Human Rights. And India says the missile it launched into Pakistan this week was fired accidentally. The Indian Ministry of Defense said the missile was fired because of a technical malfunction during routine maintenance. It described the incident as deeply regrettable and expressed relief that no one was hurt. The ministry said the government has ordered a high-level court of inquiry to investigate the incident. Pakistan said the missile was unarmed and had crashed in an area about 500 kilometers from the capital, Islamabad. Pakistan's foreign ministry also summoned India's Charge d'Affaires in Islamabad to lodge a protest.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 in the first 18 months of the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by Damien Gale. The piece is titled, UN Expert Warns Millions Suffering in Deadly Pollution Sacrifice Zones. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. United Nations expert has warned of the creation of pollution sacrifice zones across the world, where tens of millions of people are suffering strokes, cancers, respiratory problems and heart disease as a result of toxic contamination of the environment. David Boyd, a United Nations expert, told The Guardian, "There are sacrifice zones all over the world, in every region, in the north, in the south, in the east and the west, in rich countries and in poor countries." David Boyd, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, cited physical health issues, including cancer, heart disease, respiratory illness, strokes, and reproductive health problems, as well as incredible mental health problems associated with living in these places because people feel exploited and they feel stigmatized. David Boyd said, "All of this infringed their human rights, their rights to life and their rights to health, and their right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment." He added, "You cannot reconcile that fundamental right to a healthy environment with these absolutely horrific environmental conditions." In a report presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council recently, David Boyd says pollution contributed to twice as many premature deaths as COVID-19 pandemic in the first 18 months of the pandemic. Giving the death toll from pollution in that period is a staggering 9 million people, the report adds. One in six deaths in the world involves diseases caused by pollution, three times more than deaths from AIDS, malaria and tuberculosis combined, and 15 times more than from all wars, murders, and other forms of violence. David Boyd's report warns the toxification of planet Earth is intensifying, pointing out that even as some harmful chemicals are banned or abandoned, overall production of chemicals doubled between 2000 and 2017, and will double again by 2030. And while everyone was affected to some degree, some communities were being hit far more than others. David Boyd told The Guardian, "If you look at these places that I've highlighted in my report, Pollution on our planet today is pervasive. It's affecting everyone, but it's affecting some people in a really grossly unfair and disproportionate way. He said, "The United States, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, one of the wealthiest countries in all of human history, is home to one of the worst sacrifice zones on the planet. This place is called Cancer Alley in Louisiana, where there are more than 100 oil refineries, petrochemical plants, etc." David Boyd added, "And guess where they're located? In poor, predominantly black communities in Louisiana. It's just as I said, it's unconscionable." Other sacrifice zones include Kabwe in Zambia, where 95% of children had elevated levels of lead in their blood, putting them at risk of lifelong intellectual impairment. The Patarat landfill in Romania, where thousands of Roma people live and are exposed to arsenic, lead, mercury, and other pollutants. The French overseas territories of Guadeloupe and Martinique in the Caribbean, where 90% of people were found to have the carcinogenic pesticide chlorodicone in their blood. David Boyd said businesses were the main culprit, with most happy to overlook social and environmental costs in favour of their bottom line, adding that money was the main barrier to addressing the climate crisis, to addressing biodiversity loss, and to addressing pervasive pollution. He called on governments around the world to impose strong regulation on corporations causing pollution and to stop spending an estimated $1.8 trillion a year on subsidies for environmentally damaging industries. David Boyd said, "Oil and gas companies are not going to voluntarily stop producing oil and gas. Big coal companies are not going to voluntarily shift from being big coal companies to being big solar and wind companies. Governments have to do that. That's their job. It's governments that have the obligations to respect, to protect and fulfill our human rights." But he said there was cause for optimism. David Boyd's report comes 6 months after the Human Rights Council recognized for the first time that everyone had a human right to live in a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. He said, and this is really a key point, previous agreements on biodiversity and climate change and pollution were formally unenforceable. But guess what? When you weld the international environmental agreements together with human rights law brings into the equation institutions, processes and accountability. David Boyd added, that's what's really exciting about this United Nations recognition of a right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. It signals this union of human rights law and environmental law, which can be an extremely powerful catalyst of the kinds of transformative changes that we so desperately need.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Vienna talks between Iran
and the P4 plus one group of countries over the revival of the JCPOA have been paused at the request of the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, who tweeted that a final text is essentially ready and on the table and proposed a temporary halt to the talks due to what he called external factors. Iran says the pause can provide a momentum for resolving the remaining issues and a final return to the negotiations, adding that no external factor can affect the parties' joint will to go forward for a collective agreement. Iran has time and again stressed that Washington needs to make a political decision to ensure that Tehran's basic demands are met. To get further details on the decision by the EU foreign policy chief, we're now joined by our correspondent, Homa Lezgi, who's with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, what does this pause mean?
Yes, Fadio. So today, I think we heard a lot. We heard the comments from the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, when he addressed reporters and delivered a kind of statement saying, again, that this is because of external factors, as Mr. Josep Borrell said, and we are going into these pause with a hope that we can come back, he said, within days. That's the hope, which was also voiced by the Chinese ambassador when he talked to the media, that they can come back and get this done. Now, what we're hearing is also I'd like to point out the comment made by the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Ulyanov. He said that he wants to make it clear that Russia is not the sole party on whose decision the conclusion of the talks depends. He said that he wants to stress on this fact that there are lots of players involved here. It's not just Russia. Russia is only one of the participants of these negotiations. There are the interests of various parties, and there are issues that are related specifically between Iran and the U.S. and fall into that context and need to be settled between them. And he was saying, basically, you should not assume that the future or fate of these talks and their conclusion depend solely on Russia and Russia's decisions. I'd just like to also point out to a tweet from the UK representative, lead delegate in the talks. She said that she believes a fair and comprehensive deal is on the table, is ready for conclusion, and that the Iran and the US have worked hard to resolve their issues, and that the E3, in her words, are ready to conclude these talks now. However, the external factors, in her words, must be resolved in the next few days if we want to make that happen. But this is the position that the Europeans have been giving, Americans in various briefings that they've had, and also sources close to the Iranian team, however, have been saying that there are still unresolved issues between Iran and America when it comes to the scope of sanctions that need to be removed, and some other issues related to, for instance, economic guarantees, etc. What we are hearing, though, that despite these differences, they're not difficult to overcome. They can be overcome quickly if this pause creates a time for various parties to have the necessary consultations for the Russians, Americans, and the Iranians specifically to come up with the decisions that need to be taken. Then the negotiations can conclude successfully.
All right, thanks a lot, Homa Lezgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Well, joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have journalist Abbas Aslani, who's with us also from the Austrian capital, Vienna. And we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start off with Mr. Abbas Aslani in Vienna. Mr. Aslani, it's great to have you with us. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, suggested a temporary halt to the talks due to what he called external factors, one being Russia requesting guarantees for civilian nuclear projects related to the JCPOA that they will not be affected by Washington's sanctions on Moscow. How do you perceive this recess in the negotiations, and how critical of a phase have the revival negotiations reached right now?
Well, thank you for having me. In fact, the talks have reached a stage which is very close to an agreement, but they have not been able to make it. In order to finalize the text of an agreement, it seems that all the participants to the deal need to somehow find a common ground. You know, there are two sets of issues. One is that the U.S. has been lengthening the process by not, let's say, trying to abide by the lifting of the sanctions that it is supposed to lift in accordance with the JCPOA. Yesterday, Iranian foreign minister was referring to, let's say, the different and frequent changes in the messages that the U.S. has been communicating to Iran via the Joint Commission Coordinator. And they have been arguing that due to the public opinion pressure in the United States, they cannot make the decision on lifting the sanctions. So in that case, Iran will not have motivation to return to the full compliance with the nuclear deal, because Iran's, let's say, main reason to make the deal has been to economically benefit from the JCPOA. So one issue is related to the sanctions and the scope of sanctions and the quality of lifting those sanctions as well. As one senior European diplomat put forth today, was that they will have some further discussions and negotiations over the picture of how those sanctions need to be lifted. But on the other hand, recently we have been hearing some, let's say, remarks by Russian officials on receiving a written guarantee from the Western parties that the current and future EU and US sanctions, meaning over Ukraine, will not impact Russia's relations with Iran. That's why we are hearing that the European officials, as well as the American ones, they are referring to that demand as an external factor. They say that the Russian position is irrelevant to the JCPOA, and they cannot, let's say, ensure that the Iran's bilateral relations with other countries, or let's say, can, let's say, be guaranteed. But, you know, the Russian argument that the other sanctions must not impact, let's say, relations with Iran when it comes to economy or nuclear cooperation.
Okay.
That's correct. But also, on the other side, in parallel, we have the U.S., let's say, lack of decision on lifting the sanctions. What is important that is to return to the, let's say, terms of the deal based on the text of the original deal, as well as the United Nations Security Council's Resolution 2231.
Sure.
And I think this can be maybe the perspective that has been important to Iran.
Let's bring in Mr. John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. Mr. Bosnich, Iran says that Russia's request can bring a new topic to the agenda of the talks as an unanticipated component, but the main obstacle to the negotiations is the lack of a U.S. political decision to accept Iran's demands. What do you think is the main obstacle in the way of an agreement?
The U.S. government is in a state of semi-paralysis now because of the conflict in Ukraine, and this is perhaps the best example of where Biden's difficulty in keeping up to date on government affairs is crippling the U.S. operations. I would expect that during the crisis in Ukraine, the United States is going to try to buy for time, because the last thing they want to do now is add another confrontation and another problem to their plate. I expect that you should see the United States delegation delaying, trying to buy time, and trying to slow down the entire process for at least the next 3 weeks.
Mr. Aslani, a major question here is what assurances can be given that another U.S. administration doesn't come along and leave the deal again, just like the Donald Trump administration did, basically asking, should the U.S. or can the U.S. be trusted?
Well, there have been different discussions on different types of guarantees that can be given to Iran. However, the American administration have been resisting, let's say, against giving those guarantees. Earlier discussions were made on, let's say, presenting political, let's say, guarantees, or we have also had discussions on economic guarantees as well as the legal ones. For example, there have been examples on, let's say, what the Congress can do. It's somehow difficult to imagine that they would give a guarantee, but on economic ones, that if in case, let's say, any U.S. administration leaves the deal, the companies will have a period of time to be able to somehow to prepare their departure, or let's say giving some announcements politically that they won't leave the deal. But one of the most important, I can say, guarantees can be inherent guarantees, which is in fact the reversibility of Iran's nuclear potential and program. Meaning that can work as a potential leverage, that in case any party, most specifically the United States, leaves the deal, Iran can return and resume its nuclear activities at the earliest time and as quick as possible. So this could be more, I mean, practical guarantee. There has been discussions on that. I mean, some relative progress has been made. But it seems that, you know, the Americans, you know, they have not been able to make, let's say, serious actions vis-a-vis this issue. We have to see till the end that to see what is the, let's say, actual guarantees that are provided by a likely agreement. But I would say that the inherent guarantee can be the most important one, which can be followed by, or let's say, accompanied by economic guarantees as well as the political one.
John Wozniak and Alice, we spoke to here on Press TV, said that Tehran believes the U.S. wants to keep parts of the sanctions in place in order to use them as leverage to draw concessions from Iran over its regional influence and military capabilities. Do you see it in that light as well?
Absolutely. That is standard U.S. policy. The United States considers itself to be literally above the law. And when they enter into negotiations on any topic, they then have a kind of a strategy meeting in Washington in which they determine what other factors could be brought to bear. And that covers all forms of trade, that covers transportation, that covers regional communications and information transfer. So Iran has been targeted for years by the United States. The United States does not want to be friends with Iran, and the reason for this is because the U.S. policy towards Iran is largely governed by the Israel lobby in Washington. And Israel has as an objective the sidelining and the weakening of Iran. If Iran is allowed to have a good, solid nuclear energy program, it works against the interests of Israel as a regional hegemon, and therefore against the interests of America as the global hegemon.
Mr. Aslani, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says that Iran will not budge over its regional presence or its nuclear progress vis-a-vis the United States or any other power simply to protect itself against sanctions. If you may unpack those comments for us.
Well, Iran's influence or presence in the region has been source of power for the country, and this power has, let's say, created a deterrence for the country in order to deter some likely invasions against Iran, as well as it has, if that has deterred any invasions against the country, it means that it has been a cause for established peace and security in the region as well. Because if there is any war in the region, This can, let's say, bring damages to other parts of the region. This can be a fire. This can put region maybe on fire. So if these, let's say, potentials and these this deterrence has stopped a likely war, so this is in benefit for, in benefit of Iran, and this is also, let's say, this can benefit the region as well. On the other hand, you know, it is said that the U.S. as well as the West has been trying all along from the past till now to keep some sanctions in place in order to not to let Iran to benefit from the lifting of the sanctions. So the benefit Iran can enjoy can be partial. So those remaining sanctions or the structure of the sanctions, if kept in place, they can be used as a leverage for future negotiations or talks on region, on Iran's missile capability, and other areas as well. So that's why if Iran, let's say, makes compromises on its regional issues, on its defense capabilities, this will empty Iran's hands in any negotiations, even in the nuclear negotiations that are taking place. So Iran wants to make sure that it has its own tools in the its foreign policy toolbox, as well as, let's say, the power to protect itself against the foreign pressure. So that's why Iranian leader, I think, is emphasizing on the importance of the Iran's presence in the region as a source of national power and as a source of, let's say, deterrence in the region. And this can be a source for peace and stability as well for Iran and the region itself.
John Voznich, on that note, according to the leader, the U.S. propositions that Iran needs to reduce its defense power as to not provoke the enemies are extremely naive and amateurish. He said such ideas have been raised in the past but turned down every time. Ayatollah Khamenei said it would be a grave mistake for Iran to back down on its stance and it would hurt Tehran's political power. The question is, why is such a request even on the table from the United States and its allies?
That's very simple. The United States is the global bully. They pretend to be the global policemen, but actually they are a global bully. And the United States operates a protection racket, where if you come to terms with the United States, they give you some minimal ability to survive, but they make sure that you don't become independent of them, and they make sure that all of your business has to go in a manner that they can monitor and control it. I believe, and I believe most political political advisors and most political analysts would say that Iran is playing the exactly right game here by standing by its sovereignty, by pointing out that the United States is no longer in the position to swing its might around, especially with the situation in Ukraine, and this may provide Iran an opportunity to finally escape from what is in effect international blackmail by the United States.
Abbas Aslani, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, believes that the Vienna talks are becoming more complicated by the hour because the U.S. is actually refraining from making a political decision. Is Washington serious, in your opinion, or does it have ulterior motives regarding the revival of the deal?
Well, Americans, they have been, let's say, claiming to clinch a deal as soon as possible, and they have been demanding Iran and other parties to do so. But in action, what we have been seeing that they have been, let's say, protracting the process by somehow changing their messages, changing their stances, or at least, let's say, not being very active in giving the initiatives or proposals at the table. And this indicates that they have not been able to somehow contribute to the process as they were expected to. So as the time goes on, the negotiations can be more complicated, you know, because there are other, let's say, developments happening in the world, And maybe one of the issues that we are today, we are seeing a Russian demand in the negotiations, which is another issue at the table, is due to the new developments that are evolving and are taking place in the world. So there is no guarantee that we won't have new developments or new situation in the region globally. And that's why I think it can be more complicated. And in the course of the negotiations, not only we do not see any, let's say, good faith from the American side, but look what happened just recently, that Americans seized an Iranian ship. And this contradicts with what is said at the negotiating table. You know, exactly they do the opposite thing that they are supposed to do. They are seizing Iranian ship. But they are, but in action they are supposed, and in practice they are supposed to, let's say, lift the sanctions. You know, the words and the deeds do not agree. So, and that's why it is said that maybe the U.S. is not that much serious. And if they want to reach an agreement, first they have to be ready to, let's say, to return to the full compliance with the all terms of the nuclear deal, and they, let's say, actions must meet their words in practice as well.
And one last question for Mr. Bozic before we wrap up the show. How would you rate Europe's performance regarding the JCPOA and its revival? For example, their initial commitments, their stance on the U.S. abruptly leaving the deal. Have the Europeans held up their end in all of this?
The best word to use to describe them in the English language is spineless. They've shown zero backbone, they've shown zero sovereignty, and they've shown zero solidarity with the entire concept of a fair-based negotiations towards a mutually acceptable agreement. I can say that the Europeans in this particular negotiations, and in general, have shown that they are merely just following instructions from Washington, and they have disgraced themselves in these talks. And I think that Iran has done an excellent job in presenting its case clearly and defending its stance and its sovereignty. If you stay the course, your results will be much, much better than if you cave in.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist Abbas Aslani, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna, and also thanks to journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip, our ubudiyyah, our servitude to Allah, and overlooking the self in order to see the divine.
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So dear listeners, we're talking about ubudiyyah, we're talking about the servitude to Allah, we're talking about the worship of Allah, and we're talking about the obedience to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Creator and the Sustainer. Now, one of the things that we are taught by the spiritual masters, the urafa, if you will, they teach us that we will have to overlook the self if we want to see the divine. Now, another one of the things which falls under this category of overlooking the self is that we have to remove ourselves from being among the veils of this world, the hijabat, the veils, the curtains, the barriers that this materialistic world creates. And so as long as we are enwrapped in the veils and the hijabat of this world, and we live within the covers of nature, within the limitations of physicalityness and materialistness, we cannot have the knowledge of the other world. And thus, we will not be able to keep warm by a remote fire. So, of course, here we have to understand that knowledge of the other world, knowledge of the actions that we do in this world, the knowledge of the relationship between this world and the next world, the knowledge of what our purpose in this life and our purpose of life really is. This knowledge is the source of life, and it is the source of eternity, and it is the source of our human perfection. But if we become enwrapped in the veils of materialism and consumerism and capitalism and even communism and these kind of different things, if we become enwrapped in the veils of the material world, wealth, money, power, glory, etc., then we will not be able to acquire that knowledge which is beneficial to us both in this world and the next.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.